So our second speaker this morning for a coffee break is, I realise he's going to be talking to us about some earthquake compartmental modelling, and again it's work we've heard a little bit about already in this meeting, so it'll be nice to see some of the
details. Okay. The work that I'm going to be talking to you about started out when I was looking at some equations that Eric derived and stumbled across a slightly different set of variables that led to an equivalent set of equations that were somewhat nicer. And then Eric and I have done a fair amount of work with this since then. I have many affiliations, so let's get started. So what I'm going to talk to you about, I'm just going to very quickly go over the basic SIR model that we all know and probably some of us love. And then I'm going to point out how this model might fail on a network. And then I'm going to, once I've shown you some examples of how it fails on networks, I'll go through, explain what kind of networks I actually want to study. There'll be configuration model networks. I'll discuss how people have in the past derived the final sizes for epidemics in networks, and then I'm going to show how that same approach basically gets you the dynamics of epidemics on SIR epidemics on configuration model networks. And then I'm going to start talking about dynamic populations as well. So things where there's basically edge swapping going on, so the degrees stay the same all the time, but people change their partners. And then also an example where what I call dormant contact and what Oda Diekmann was calling binding sites, where you've got the potential for partnerships, but you don't always have an active binding site. You have a binding site, sometimes it's active, sometimes it's inactive, or the terminology I've used, it's dormant or it's active. So let's start off with just a little bit the basic SIR model. You'll see these faces a few times in this talk. You start off with individuals beginning susceptible, so focus on the central person here. And you can think about the SIR model, the mass action model, is basically an individual will be constantly changing its partners, and if at some point it encounters an infected individual, it becomes infected. And then once it's infected, it continues changing its partners and it can infect others, and then at some rate it recovers. And the basic colors I'm going to be using is blue is susceptible, red is infected, and yellow is recovered. That's the basic idea. We can draw a little compartmental model. I would call this a flow diagram, where we have susceptible, infected, recovers. Individuals begin susceptible, they become infected, they recover, and we can assign rates to these edges. So I'm going to talk about S as the proportion that's susceptible, I is the proportion infected, R is the proportion. So I want to emphasize that these things are going to add up to one, they're proportions. The flow from the S compartment to the I compartment is beta times I times S. The flow from I to R, gamma times I. You've seen these sorts of assumptions before. You get these equations, and you can solve them. Very easy. Epidemic goes up, epidemic goes down. We saw that yesterday, I believe. But if we try to do this on, in this case, static configuration model networks with different degree distributions, it's the same disease that I just described. This is the curve I showed you here. It's that curve. And then for these different populations, I ran simulations in very large networks. Those gave me the solid curves. And then the dashed curves is a theory that I'm going to show you. And the theory is something that's provably exact, or at least there was mention yesterday of a paper that proves it, and like Thomas, I have to admit I can't understand that paper entirely. But I believe it's provable. I certainly believe it's exact. I'm going to talk to you about how we can derive some. So basically I'm going to show you how to derive equations that will allow me to figure out what these dashed curves are. and they're going to be very simple differential equations. There's really going to be a single differential equation to solve, and then a few other little auxiliary equations that go along for the ride. But I'm going to basically reduce the problem to solving a single ODE that depends on the degree distribution. So the networks I'm going to study, well, it's going to be configuration model, basically. I'm going to, the thing that I want to really think about is that different people have different numbers of partners. Here is an example. Here half the population has three partners, half the population has one partner. And it's been mentioned a few times that your friends probably have more friends than you do, in a sense that this isn't a statement about the people in the audience, it's a statement about the fact that you are randomly chosen in some sense. So when you're forming your partnerships in the configuration model, you're looking for a partner among all the available links you could form, and you're just more likely to form a partnership with somebody who is looking for more partners. You know, so there's just a natural bias in all that's been shown a little bit already, and when it comes up, I'll show it again. For the first part of this talk, I'm going to assume that the network is static. The partnerships don't change. So this is the Quinch model. I will hit the Neil version later. Sorry, I actually did not manage to sleep last night, so my brain froze on that. But right now I'm assuming it's static. Here, I'm going to talk about partnership changes. But right now it's static. I'm going to assume there's a very small number of initial infectors. So the port, it's going to be basically in the limit of in going to infinity, the number of nodes in the network going to infinity, but the proportion infected is going to zero. This is not a necessary assumption. It can be eliminated, but that just would extend the talk a bit too much. And I'm going to assume that the disease is this very simple disease that transmits at rate beta per partnership, and I like them recovering at rate gamma. So gamma for me is the recovery rate. The transmission rate is pretty consistent across all the talks. The recovery rate, this is delta from the last talk. But when they recover, they have immunity in my model. And so that I don't get into what Rabikman was talking about, I'm going to assume that it's a closed population. There's no birth, there's no death. You can go in that direction, but I'm not going there. Okay, so the results for the final size of SIR epidemics in these networks have been known for over a decade now. But I'm going to go through it. I'm going to go through it in a slightly different, it's going to end up being an identical calculation to what others have done, but I'm going to present it a little bit differently than perhaps often presented. So what my argument is basically is that at the end of the epidemic, if I choose a random individual, the probability that random individual is susceptible must be equal to the proportion of the population that's still susceptible. He's randomly chosen from the population, he's going to be susceptible with probability equal to the proportion that is susceptible. On the other hand, the probability he's susceptible depends on his partners, his neighbors. I'll be able to calculate the probability this individual is susceptible in terms of the probability that his neighbors are susceptible. And then it follows through after that. So I'm going to make an assumption that this randomly chosen individual is disallowed, is prevented from causing any infection. This just lets me treat his partners as really independent. It's not going to affect the probability that this randomly chosen individual ever gets infected. It just means that if he gets infected by one partner, his other partners aren't at higher risk of getting infected. I'll explain this a little bit more when I actually use that assumption. And I'm looking at final size, the probability that this individual is susceptible or recovered, he can't be still infectious at the end, it's SIR, and I'm at the end of the epidemic. probability he's susceptible or recovered is going to be dependent on the status of his partners, but it's going to be also equal to the probability that this individual is susceptible. So the fraction of the population that's susceptible is the probability that this individual is susceptible, and that's the key thing that's going to make this approach work. Okay. So on the other hand, the probability he's susceptible is going to depend on his partners. So I'm going to choose. So I've chosen one random individual who I call the test individual. And I'm going to look at a partner of that individual and look for the probability that that partner has or has not transmitted. So introducing a variable theta, which is the probability that this partner did not transmit. So here we go. I've got a central individual, and I want to know the probability this individual is susceptible at the end of the epidemic. The probability that this partner never transmitted during the course of the epidemic is theta. The probability that this partner never transmitted is theta. He's got k partners. I can calculate the probability he's still susceptible. So if he's a random individual, degree k, the probability he's still susceptible is different than k. All right? This is, I have independence of partners because it's a configuration model. Okay. On the other hand, I don't want to know what the probability is for a random degree k individual. I'm choosing my individual to be a random individual, so I have to sum up over all possible k, and that's this probability generating function that has shown up a few times in some talks. If you aren't familiar with probability generating functions, don't worry. It's that sum. It's a summation. But if you are familiar with them, they have some nice properties. You know, basically what's nice is that if I give you a kind of reasonable degree distribution, there's a good chance that this function has a nice closed form. So if I know theta, if I know the probability that a random neighbor does not transmit to my random individual, I know the proportion of the population that's still susceptible, therefore I know the proportion of the population that got infected. So I end up I'll be done if I know theta, but I need to figure out theta. So going back, so here's you, call this individual B, okay? And we need to know whether or not B has transmitted to you. So now we're going to switch our focus to V. Okay? The probability that B is still susceptible if V has degree K is theta to the k minus 1. The reason for the minus 1 is that I'm calculating the probability that B has transmitted to you. I don't want to think about B transmitted to you because B was affected by you sometime earlier. That's irrelevant. Okay? I'm waving hands a little bit. This is a rigorous statement. It can be made rigorous. So the probability that if B has a degree k, the probability B is still susceptible, theta to the k minus 1. I go through the same sort of calculation that I just did, except I have a different distribution for the degrees of neighbors. It turns out that it looks like k times p of k divided by gamma of k. I think I've seen at least three talks put up this expression, but this is that statement that partners tend to have higher degree than random individuals. And if you look at this, there's a sum of k, p of k, theta to the k minus 1. That looks sort of like the derivative of p of k, theta to the k. So it turns out the numerator is psi prime to theta. The denominator, I find it a little bit nicer if I'm writing the numerator as psi prime. It's nice to write the denominator psi prime to 1. It's just the average of k. So what do I know? I know the probability now that this individual, I know the probability that B is never infected, call that phi s. So this is the probability that the neighbor of my original test individual is still susceptible. So from this, I can then calculate the probability that the neighbor never transmits. So if phi s is the probability that B never gets infected, and the probability B never transmits to you is phi s plus 1 minus phi s times the probability. So this is the probability B never is infected. This is the probability B gets infected. the probability that he doesn't transmit. So T is the transmission probability. Given that B is infected, 1 minus T is the probability he doesn't transmit. So we basically got two things that I'm adding up. Either B is never infected, or B is infected but doesn't transmit. You do a bit of algebra, you get to this expression, which has also a nice interpretation. 1 minus T is the probability that B wouldn't transmit, regardless of whether he gets infected. And then this term T is the probability he would transmit times the probability he never gets infected. So there's two ways to think about this expression. They're obviously both equal. So I've got an expression now for theta way over here in terms of theta. So there's algorithms to solve this. It turns out actually that it converges very quickly if you just iterate. Just take a guess with theta, plug it in, and just iterate to Cobb of diagonals. So what do I know? I've got the final proportion recovered is 1 minus psi of theta, where theta solves that equation. Okay, that's a calculation that people have done for at least a decade. It's fairly straightforward. But I want to talk now about the dynamics. I want to talk about, instead of final size, I want to talk about how many are infected at a given time. Okay, so not at infinity, but at a particular time. So we sort of, we're going to see something. The picture I'm about to put up looks a lot like the picture I put up for the standard SIR model initially, except that I don't know how people go from susceptible to infected. That's going to be the complicated part. Once they're infected, they're going to recover at rate gamma. So we get flow from the I to the R compartment. It looks like gamma times I. So that's going to stay the same. I get R dot is gamma times I. These three things have to add up to 1, so I'm going to take I as 1 minus S minus R. And I'm going to have to figure out what S is. Now, I showed you how to figure out what S is at the end of the epidemic. Now I'm going to show you how to figure out what S is at some time in the middle of the epidemic. And if I can get that, then everything else is going to follow through. Any questions at this point? Okay. So it's going to be basically the same approach. I'm going to choose a random test individual. I'm going to not allow them to transmit to any partners. I'm going to now recognize that I don't just worry about susceptible or recovered. I also have to worry about whether he's infected at a given time. I still have this expression. That, you know, I still have the probability that he's susceptible at a given time is equal to the proportion of the population susceptible at a given time is equal to the probability that the individual is susceptible at that time. He's randomly chosen. And what I'm now going to do is look at a random partner of this random individual, and I'm going to talk about theta as a function of time, which is the probability that this random partner V has not yet. This is the only thing I'm changing. I'm putting the word yet in here. Has not yet transmitted to you. Okay. So I'm going to use very similar calculations. And I'm just focusing on now it's during the middle of the epidemic rather than at the end. So let's find S of T if we know theta of T. Theta of t is a probability that hasn't yet been transmitted. Well, probability, if he's got degree k, probability he's still susceptible to theta k. I sum up over all degrees. That's psi of theta of t. This is exactly the same set of slides I showed you earlier, except I just put t in there. Okay, so that's going to be the same. So if I know theta of t, I'm done. How am I identifying theta of t? This is the new thing. So I've got my individual U, I've got a partner V, and with probability theta, there has not yet been transmission from V to U. With probability 1 minus theta, there has been transmission. So really what I need to do is figure out how much flow there is from this box to this box. If I can figure that out, I've got a differential equation for theta. But I'm going to need to actually break theta up into three cases. So theta says B has not transmitted to you. B may be still susceptible. B may be infected but hasn't yet transmitted. B may be recovered and did not transmit while infected. These are are the three possibilities. And there's the only way you get to this box is while B is infected, B could transmit. And then maybe B recovers, maybe B hasn't yet recovered. I don't care about that at that point. All I care about is whether or not you're in this box or down here. So theta, so if I call phi s the probability that B is still susceptible, phi I the probability that B is infected but has not yet transmitted, phi r the probability B recovered and did not transmit, then theta is phi s plus phi I plus phi r. Okay, it's just, those are all the possible ways that transmission hasn't happened yet. I can figure out what some of these fluxes are. So the flow from phi I to phi r, they recover at rate gamma. So the flow of stuff from this compartment to that compartment is at rate gamma phi r. Okay. The flow from this compartment down to here is beta times phi I. This is the transmission rate. Okay, we good? All right, what I need to do, I've got theta dot is negative theta phi I. That's because of this flow here. If I can figure out what phi I is in terms of theta, I'm done. I've got an equation done for theta dot in terms of just theta in the string. What I'm going to do is I have this equation that I know these three things add up to theta. I'm going to figure out what this is. I'm going to figure out what this is. And then that's going to lead me an expression for phi r. So, what I'm going to start with is by looking at the fact that this flow and that flow report on each other. Okay? So, because the recovery rate and the transmission rates are proportional to each other, basically, there's a certain rate of there's a certain probability you end up here, there's a certain probability you end up there. So I sometimes give the analogy that if I have two swimming pools, I have different numbers of hoses going to each swimming pool, but the flow through each hose are always the same. They may vary in time, but all the hoses vary the same way in time. Then the amount of water in one of them is proportional to the number of hoses going to that one. The amount of water in the other one is proportional to the number of hoses going to it. So these two boxes, they start off at zero, they're going to have to be proportional to each other. That gives me phi r is gamma over beta times 1 minus theta. Okay? So that means I know phi r. I need to know phi s. Well, I've actually already shown you how to figure out phi s. Phi s is the probability that the partner is still susceptible. So here's u, here's v. What's the probability that the v is still susceptible? Well, I look at the other k minus 1 partners of V, none of periodic probability, none of them have transmitted, and then I have to average over the possible degrees of V. This is exactly the same set of slides I showed you a little bit ago, except that I put a T there, but I forgot to add the T back here. But it's psi prime of theta of T over psi prime of 1, that's phi S. That's the probability that the partner is still susceptible at a given time. Well, so what do I have now? I have a function of theta here. I have a function of theta for this. I know how much is in those two boxes. I know that these three boxes add up to theta. So that tells me that phi I looks like theta minus psi prime of theta over psi prime of 1 minus gamma over beta times 1 minus theta. Okay? The flow into this 1 minus theta compartment is or the flow out of the theta compartment is beta phi I. That was, again, this equation that theta dot is minus beta phi I. And now I just substitute this for phi I, and I've got an expression for the pi derivative of theta in terms of theta. It's a nice, simple ODE. It's really only got one term that's kind of nonlinear. Okay, you've got a constant term in there, but it's very simple. You can plug this into any numerical solver you want. This is the system of the equation to end up with. This first equation governs everything. These next three equations are just because what we actually care about is the number of people who are susceptible, affected, or recovered. So we need to kind of pull that out. You've got that? How does it do? Well, I've shown you how it does already. The dashed curves are solutions to those equations. The solid curves are simulations on networks with degree distributions that match up with these things, but much larger networks. Okay. Again, this is these equations look a little bit different from the ones that Eric came up with. They are equivalent, some people have shown that the equations Eric came up with are correct, provably correct, so I'm happy with that.
Sure.
Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Where? Where do I use it? It gets me the argument that it lets me, so the probability that he is susceptible is, okay, theta to the, let me go back to degree k individual, the probability he's susceptible is theta to the k, where theta is defined to be the probability that this individual has never transmitted there. Now, if I allow transmission to go from here to here and then to here, well, now transmission might happen this way. And so I would need to have a slightly different thing, and it gets hideously complicated, and I bang my head, and
So I think it's better here would be the order. At this point, you've got the order 1 over any bracket.
Okay.
If you're not in a large population,
okay. Okay. All right. I have not thought through what happens with noise or finite sizes. Okay. So we are now there. Okay. So we've got a solution that works in a limit of large networks for static configuration model networks. Okay. Now, everybody who has never changed their fringe, raise your hand. Exactly. Everybody has changed, partnerships change. Okay, so you really want to be able to think about that. So I'm going to think about two models, unless Ken starts waving his hand at me, in which we have where we allow partners to change. In this first one, the degrees won't change. So what's going to happen is that I start off with a population here, and then I have, in this case, I've got three edges. I have a few edges that break, and immediately they reform in a slightly different configuration. So the partners change, but they change in such a way that the degrees always remain the same. Okay, so this sort of algorithm is often used to generate sort of random networks. You start doing a lot of edge swapping. Well, in this case, I'm doing edge swapping as the actual behavior of the individuals. And I'm going to assume that all edges have a rate, the same rate, gamma, but eta, at which they break. Okay, so all edges are going to break at the same rate. There's nothing in what I'm doing here where some edges might be sort of stronger than others. But this is the sort of picture we have. And, well, I'm going to try to do very much the same game. This is the picture that I've already showed you. I've got bias. Bias is now, its definition is going to change a little bit.
Sorry.
Yes.
Can you go back to that? So you break edges and break eta, and then new edges appear at the same rate?
They appear immediately. So
between the same node?
This node, this edge breaks,
mm-hmm.
and all three of there's three red edges here that break, and immediately, those individuals who have broken an edge form new partners with other people
The individuals involved in the link that has been broken.
Yeah. So everybody, they always have to break at least in pairs.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's always rewiring. You always, when you break your partnership, you always find a new partner.
So you break two partners.
You have to have at least two edges break at the same time. So you have to be a little bit careful with you know, you, with how you, when you're simulating, you have to think a little bit about how you, the rate at which you choose two edges to break.
But then you preserve the degrees.
Degrees are always preserved.
Then this is an anneal.
But it's not.
Well, if eta is
it's not in the if eta is infinite, it's anneal.
Then it's anneal.
And yes. If eta is zero, it's static. But here I can put in.
An epidemic, a changing so many
well, so I can put this rate to be. I can interpolate. So I would say I can interpolate between quenched and annealed. Yeah.
You know, the point is that actually the theta does not act on an end. You're not just calculating an end. You're doing much more than calculating an end. You know, if you do an end, then you have to be very excited about what you're doing.
Yeah.
I just like to do, I can before any better map.
Yeah.
I just like to do the whole graph anyway, for which way it's not.
So, here. Yeah. So, what's going on is basically, I can see it may become more obvious later when I go to another limit where you don't even need to reform the partnerships. But basically, the number of edges that are breaking at any time is a tiny fraction of the total number of edges. So at any moment, basically you have two edges breaking. Generally, the way you could in principle allow three edges. I've shown that as an example, but it's a tiny fraction of all the edges. And I'm in the limit of an infinite population with two edges breaking at a time.
Do you control but for multiple connections?
Eric, was there anything in the simulations to control against forming like multiple edges or jump loops or? Yeah. So as long as you make sure that the edges don't. So I think if you start out without multiple edges, I'll need to think about whether that. But it's a
well,
tiny
it's
fraction.
A problem.
Okay. Yeah. So for many networks, anyways, this is going to be a tiny fraction of the edges as the limit goes to infinity. Scale free. So let me actually show you something that could be a little bit of an issue for scale free. It's not going to. So scale free, when you linearize this, you'll end up taking a derivative of this, and you'll get a psi double prime of 1, which is sort of the initial infinite growth. So there's a little bit that goes on immediately. But then once you're out of the regime where you have the high degree nodes still affected,
you have a worse problem with the scale free, because then those equations are not exact, because you always have the degree correlation.
So I have not thought very much about how this works at scale free. I've basically gone with the assumptions that things converge nicely as n goes to infinity. Yes, scale free things can cause some headache because when I take the derivative of this, if for no other reason than because when I take the derivative of this evaluated at theta equals 1, which is where I want to linearize, I'm going to get infinity.
So I think the proof relies on some moments in time.
Yeah, so the proof where it's proven to be correct, they did rely on, I think it was the fifth moment to be finite, but when I saw the guy talking about it, he felt that was stronger than
the assumption that you make that the probability of the neighbor is kp of k divided by
mm-hmm.
LTV is not true if.
So there are numerical problems.
It depends on the degree of your.
So scale free networks, there may be some things to worry about. Okay. So this picture is the same picture I showed you, except I've made this box bigger. You'll see why in a second. So phi s, I'm going to change the definition of phi s slightly. Phi s was the probability that the partner's susceptible. Now it's the probability that you've got a partner that's susceptible, and at no time in the past has this stub, the connection to that partner, ever transmitted infection. Because you've been changing your partners in time. It may be that previously you were connected to an infected person, now you're connected to a susceptible person. I'm going to have to say phi s is the probability that a stub has never received infection from the partner, and is currently connected to a susceptible. Same sort of thing for infectious, same sort of thing for recovery. Okay? Now, edges break at rate eta, so let's start off by thinking about one of the, an edge that connects me to a recovered individual. That breaks at rate eta. So the flow I get out of this box looks like eta by r. And that is going to reconnect to an, another partner who will be susceptible, infected, or recovered. And I'll show, I'll need to work out the probability it connects to a susceptible, infected, or recovered partner. But it's just going to, when this edge breaks, when an edge breaks to a recovered individual, I'm going to reform a new partnership with someone who may be susceptible, infected, or recovered. So I, when I leave this compartment, I may end up in any of those three compartments. Similarly, when I leave, when I break an edge with a susceptible individual or when I break an edge with an infected individual, same sort of thing happens. The total flux coming out of all three of these adds up to eta times theta. Okay? And then I need to figure out the probability that the new partner is susceptible, infected, or recovered. And to know that, I need to know what proportion of all the subs that are out there belong to infected individuals, what proportion of all the subs that are out there belong to susceptible individuals, and what proportion belong to recovered individuals. Because my new partner is basically being chosen randomly from all the stubs. So I'm selecting him based on one of his stubs. So I need to know what proportion of stubs are in each case. And so, well, I think my next slide I work out pi s. Oh, no. I'm no longer going to be able to get a simple expression for pi s, so there's a headache that gets me what the flow is there. If you want to know it, read the paper. I'm not going to put it here, but the flow is beta times phi I times phi s, and psi double prime to theta over psi prime to theta, which is a kind of weird term to show up. So I need to figure out, what proportion of the new edges are with susceptible individuals. I need to figure out what proportion of all stubs out there belong to susceptible individuals. So now I'm going to look at a random edge, or actually a random stub. So choose a random stub, look at the person who owns it, and I need to figure out the probability he's susceptible. If he's got degree k, he's susceptible with probability pn of k, this probability that the neighbor has degree k, theta to the k. There's no minus one going on here because this is just a random edge out there. It's not a random edge that belongs to my focus individual. So the probability this person has been selected with probability proportional to his degree, probability he's still susceptible is theta to the k with the fact, with the weighting factor for the fact he's chosen proportional to his degree. I've got to sum that up over all degrees. I go through this, and I get almost the same thing except there's an extra factor of theta. It's theta psi prime to theta over psi prime to 1. So that's pi s. That's this box. So this is saying the proportion of all stubs that belong to susceptible individuals is theta psi prime to theta over psi prime to 1. If I have a stub that belongs to an infected individual, that infected individual recovers at rate gamma. So I have the rate at which I go from a stub that belongs to an infected individual to a stub that belongs to a recovered individual is gamma pi I. So it tells me pi r dot is gamma pi I. And well, the proportion of all stubs that are stubs adds up to 1. So these three things have to add up. So I say pi I is 1 minus pi s minus pi I. Now I've got an expression for pi s. So if I know theta, then I know the probability that I can work out the probability that a stub belongs to a susceptible, infected, recovered individual, which tells me the probability my new partner is susceptible, infected, recovered. So that tells me what the flow is going into each of these boxes from this whole edge swapping theta. So, well, I need to figure out theta again. Theta, the derivative of theta is negative theta pi I, but I can no longer work out the nice expression I had for pi I that I did before. So I'm going to have to actually figure out the derivative of pi I. Well, I look at what's coming into it and subtract what's coming out of it. So I've got theta pi I pi s pi over prime over psi prime plus eta theta pi I minus eta pi I minus gamma pi I minus theta pi I. Pi s shows up in there, so I'm going to need to work out pi s as well. The same sort of thing works. You know, it's, at this point, it's just sort of bookkeeping. I've drawn all my arrows. I've labeled all my arrows. I just have to figure out what my differential equations are. What comes of that? Well, I get a system of equations. There's a few more ODEs now. But I've added to the network a typical duration of partnerships. So I've added a fair amount of complexity to my network. I've got partners changing. I can say how long they last on average. And I can have a fairly arbitrary degree distribution. And I got a fixed number of equations. It doesn't matter how large my largest degree is, as long as we aren't dealing with scale 3. We get that. So those are sort of the final equations that come out. How does it do? Well, pretty well. The dashed curve is solutions to those equations. The solutions, your numerical solver will get that for you in a few seconds, if that long. And then your solid curve is, well, here it's 102 simulations in the population of 10 to the fourth individuals. We had to do that because it was kind of hard to simulate in really large populations. You've got a lot of stuff going on in there. There's a little bit of an issue that shows up from the fact that I'm averaging, that turns out to not really affect the picture. But you know, there was a potential that the averaging was going to kill this bit, even though in the large in limit it was going to work great. So we can accurately capture this. I've chosen a negative binomial. The degree distribution happens to have this form. Turns out that my generating function has a nice form. It's just basically one. It's a constant number of polynomials. So it turns out that it's fairly easy to do the calculations. Okay. So I've now dealt with static populations. I've dealt with populations where the degrees always remain the same, but the partners change in time. I want to allow the degrees to change now.
Have you checked the evolution of how the behavior changes with eta? From quench network to
I don't.
What is the difference between the two?
So basically, the main difference is that the infections are happening at the same, the transmissions are happening at the same rate, recoveries are happening at the same rate. But what happens is in the annealed version, in the quench version, there's a potential that when I transmit, it may be to the person who transmitted to me, or it may be to someone who I've already transmitted to, so they're lost infections.
Yeah, but then when
so as we increase eta, it's going to, it'll tend to speed things up a bit. So there are fewer lost infections. So the final sizes will also be larger.
But the changes...
I'm sure I can get... If I choose my parameters, I bet
very close to this picture.
That's going to depend on the parameters. The value of R naught is different, so I can even get epidemics to happen in some cases where they don't in the other. So yeah, I can get a range of things if I play with it. It does converge to something. It's not like it keeps changing and changing as I speed up eta. Eventually, I get nothing more out of making eta bigger. And there's a paper where we deal with how all these limits behave, and I do show pictures of some of the convergence going on there. Okay, how am I doing on time? All right. So now I want to talk about a case where I allow degrees to change in time. But I still have some people tend to have more contacts than others. So this is what Odomu was talking about, where you have binding sites, except I'm allowing different individuals to have different numbers of binding sites. So I'm going to use slightly different notation from what others use. I'm going to have a population where individuals have case studs, binding sites, not all of which may be active at any given time. If I've got a dormant stub, there's a rate 8 of 1 at which it becomes active. That's the rate it finds a new partner, forms a partnership. And if it's an active, meaning it's part of an edge already, it becomes dormant at rate 8 of 2. So here's a picture. We've got an edge here. As a little bit later, that edge is broken, and I've got, it's just become two little stubs connected to these nodes. I also have a stub here and a stub here, and at some rate, you know, those stubs become active. They find a new partner from among the other dormant stubs. You have a question?
When you dormant stub, means two stubs.
Yeah, so a given dormant stub becomes active at this particular rate. When it becomes active, obviously, there's got to be another one that's becoming active at the same time. But aside from that little bit of correlation, everything else is independent.
But if eta 1 and eta 2 are the same, this is not exactly the same model that you were doing?
No. If eta 1 is infinity, it's the same model I had. So if eta 1 is infinity, means that when it becomes dormant, it immediately becomes active again. If they're the same, then you have half of them are dormant, half of them are active. So. So this is the picture I showed you for the case where the degrees stay the same. What's going to happen now is I need to include the possibility that I have a stub that is currently not connected to anybody. So I'm going to put him at a new box up there. Call it 5D. This is the probability a stub is currently dormant and has never transmitted infection to the individual that belongs to. I'm going to need to worry a little bit more about how the probability that the new partner is susceptible to infection recovered. I'm not choosing my new partner to be, you know, along a random stub. I'm choosing them to be along a random stub that is dormant. And the probability somebody is susceptible to infection recovered is going to be slightly different depending on whether the stub is dormant or active. So I need to separate out pi s is the probability that a stub belongs to a susceptible individual and is dormant. Psi s is the probability that a stub belongs to a susceptible individual and is active. Similar sorts of things. You get these fluxes that work out that at a particular rate a stub goes from dormant to active, a particular rate it goes back to being dormant, and there's a particular rate that stubs that belong to a susceptible individual become stubs that belong to affected individuals, and so forth. So, you know, I can get this picture. As I think about each edge, I can pretty much work out a lot of the flows that are very similar to things that I've already said. I'm not going to go into detail on this. You get some equations. It's more equations, no question. But again, it's a finite number of equations. It doesn't grow as, say, the maximum degree increases. It's something that really, you know, once you know the degree distribution, you just plug it in to a few spots, and you plug your parameters in, and you can solve it. How does it do? It does pretty well. It should do pretty well, as long as I'm not in the case where the proof that these things converge fails. So all of that, everything I've just talked about, is in a paper in the Royal Society Interface. We then took all of these different the models I showed you and some additional models that we derived, and in a separate paper we've worked out what cases are special cases of the others. So what I call mean field social heterogeneity is your very quickly rewiring network. Okay, that's not finished.
Anil.
Why am I having trouble with that? Okay, so that's it. So this is the Anil. It's SIR. It's the SIR case, but you can get some fairly simple equations out of that. What I've shown you is this dormant version, a dynamic network that's got fixed degree, and the configuration model. There's all those in appropriate limits, can be pumping a needle. So in fact, you can have, if you've got a static network that's has very large degrees but very low transmission probabilities, the probability that I transmit to the same person twice and the probability that I transmit to the person who transmitted to me is basically zero. So it really doesn't matter whether I'm changing my partnerships or whether I'm keeping them the same all the time. The disease never crosses the same edge twice, it never sees the same connection twice. So even the static network, even in those limits, becomes the same. So the quicks and the needle become the same in that limit. And so we can work out all sorts of limits where these things reduce to one another. The cases where there's two arrows means there's more than one limit where they reduce to one another. And in fact, you can show that the annealed case, if the degree distribution is not too wide, which actually surprisingly means the average degree goes to infinity, but the average fourth power divided by the average degree goes to one. If that holds, not the square, but the fourth power, then you get mass action out of any of these ones. And beta looks like 1 over the average. If those hold, you get mass action out. So that's basically it. What are my conclusions? Fairly complex structure can be captured by a small number of equations for SIR models if you've got the appropriate sort of assumptions. And I'm just going to throw up a little thing that's not really a conclusion, but the same method that I used to derive those expressions can be applied to the mass action model. You actually get that system of equations, which turns out to be equivalent to the mass action model. What is it? So that's actually just one difference with equation. Okay. If there's any questions.
Thank you. We've had quite a bit of discussion, but we still have time for questions.
Just to summarize, so this model, the model that you have proposed, in the case of the configuration method, is an exact model.
In the limit, so.
But your model gives you an evolution in time, aggregating the nodes. So do you think you can obtain spatial information on the progress of the disease and somehow modify?
So the key bit of this is that my partners are basically independent of one another. If I can come up with a way that I can have spatial structure in the network where my partners are still independent of one another, which is doable if I'm thinking about I have large populations in an area, I can still think that it's doable, but you have to be very careful about how you're constructing the network to allow you to do that. There's only certain types of networks where this approach will work. And so
but
now
then
I'm
your equations will become at least
I would have space in it somehow.
Right.
So I would have to think about the proportion of those in a location that are susceptible.
The state of each node.
Well, I'm not really thinking about each node. I think everything I'm doing is kind of an aggregate. It's proportion of those.
So it is correct for our that there are no exact equations for the SIR available?
So for what yours?
Exactly the same. If you have a network, whatever it is, and you.
I certainly don't know of anybody who's tried to write down anything like that. I presume that you can write down the same diagrams you did. Just some of those transitions can't happen because you don't have to go back to susceptible. So it would be a smaller
I think it'll be a smaller, but
have three to the power.
There's three possibilities, yes.
Three to the power and
But you can't go. I think you would maybe have the same number of edges. I don't know. I'd have to think about it. But I think the sort of picture I don't think anybody has done that sort of thing.
It's an awesome exercise.
Well, there's a lot of people who are here these passive models, but there's a complete graph, they're analyzing master.
The underlying objective is a given graph, you don't know, only the edges are here. Two people apply for the pen graph.
So some people analyze the whole graph equations, but you kind of know that you can't do much better than that.
So the approach you use, I haven't seen any here looks like that. I don't see any reason why it shouldn't apply here.
Just for the other thing, see how good your model that is.
If I understand that the final size is true also for non-line copy and recovery rate.
Yes.
I was wondering, can you do something about the dynamic, perhaps instead of getting a differential equation, getting an integral equation, if things
There's a paper that recently came out of PLOS One by actually some people who work with Gene Stanley. He was not a person who worked with him. That paper dealt with discrete time, where there's some discrete, there's a deterministic amount of time before you recover, everybody recovered after an exact amount of time. If I wanted to do a more complicated, I got a different distribution of the exponential, I've got some other distribution of recovery times, it's doable. People have thought about this for the Nasdaq and SIR model. It's going to be the same kind of result.
Well, such information is somewhat hidden in the paper that Mike de Jong, Hans Metz and I published many years ago.
Yeah.
It's a one-dimensional or a new dimension.
Thank you. I think it's coffee time. Thank you.